is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Pakcast, a weekly audio dialogue between Pakistan and the West. This is Volume 3, Installment 10 of Pakcast. I'm Ethan Casey, author of Alive and Well in Pakistan.
And I am Nasser Aziz, producer Pakcast.
Again this week, for the second week in a row, we have a special installment of Pakcast, a special full-length 30-minute interview. This time it's with the Pakistani novelist Mohsin Hamid, whose new novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, was published just a few weeks ago in the UK and more recently in the US.
And you were with Layla Kazmi?
Yeah, Layla Kazmi, who's a Pakistani friend of ours based here in Seattle, and alerted me to the fact that Mohsin was coming to Seattle on a book tour. And he was giving a talk at Elliott Bay Book Company, which is the very good independent bookstore.
And a cafe.
And cafe here in downtown Seattle.
Actually, I wanted to be there, but I just had this long-running meeting. I couldn't make it. But thank you for doing this, you, Ethan, and Layla Kazmi, both of you. So what's this Reluctant Fundamentalist about?
It's a short novel, about 180 pages, and it's written in a very special kind of first-person voice, narrated by a Pakistani who has lived in America. Mm-hmm. And graduated from Princeton, one of the great universities in America, and worked in the business world in New York, but then became disenchanted with America and returned to live in Pakistan. And the whole novel is cast as his side of a conversation between him and an American he happens to meet in a cafe or restaurant in Lahore.
So this character in this novel is author. Is the author talking about himself, or is...
Well, he actually, Mohsin Hamid makes a point in the interview.
So didn't he go to Princeton himself?
He did go to Princeton. He has worked in business in New York.
So it's not an autobiography or anything.
But it's not an autobiography. I think any novelist, especially one who writes in the first person, exposes himself to that accusation, if you will, that no, what you wrote, it must be autobiographical. Mm-hmm. He says, of course, there are elements of his own experience in this novel, as in his previous novel, Moth Smoke, but it is fiction. It's not, the character Cengiz is not meant to be Mohsin Hamid, the author.
So what's the storyline? It's like a political, what is it about?
I haven't read it yet. I'm looking forward to reading it very much. It is, as he puts it, one half of a dialogue between the Muslim world and the West. And of course, that's very relevant to what Pakcast is all about.
I was going to say, it's like similar stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And buy it, read it, and before you do, listen to this really terrific interview. Many thanks to Mohsin Hamid for being available to us.
And Layla Kazmi, of course.
Especially to Layla Kazmi to bring this opportunity to us. Layla is a good friend and colleague, and we look forward to having her on the podcast many times in the future.
And I'm looking forward to listening to this interview too, so let's go at it.
Okay, Ethan Casey and Layla Kazmi with Mohsin Hamid at Elliott Bay Books, April 12th, 2007. Thanks very much for being available to us.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
The first question, before Layla asks you some questions about your new novel, your very intriguing new novel, I'd like to ask first, why the 7 years between novels?
Well, my first novel, Moth Smoke, took 7 years as well. And it was many different drafts over that time, each one sort of completely reinventing what went before, often without even looking at the previous draft. And I thought this time I knew what I was doing and I would do it much more quickly, but exactly the same thing happened. It was 6 or 7 drafts over 7 years, over 1,000 pages of manuscript to produce a tiny little 180-page book.
Mohsin, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, it's a monologue between a Pakistani man who encounters an American at a cafe in Lahore, where he and then he ends up telling the American his story of having lived in America. And I read that you started the novel before September 11th happened. Or you maybe did your first draft before? And so how did the story is about a Pakistani guy who lives, who's born and raised in Pakistan, Lahore, and then he goes to America, attends Princeton, finishes law school, and then he works in corporate America, and his struggle, his love for America and the struggle after September 11th, feeling guilty, wanting to go back to Pakistan. So how did September 11th change your novel?
Well, it's funny because the first draft, which I started in the summer of 2000 and finished around July 2001, so before 9/11, was a story of a Pakistani Muslim guy living in New York, working in the corporate world, and asking himself the question, you know, do I still want to do this corporate work? And also asking the question, should I stay in America or should I leave? And this growing sense of alienation from resentment towards America, but also a great attachment to America. And it was a love story. And so in some senses, the novel hasn't changed at all, really. Obviously, after I wrote that book, I wrote it almost as a parable. It was a very stripped-down, almost fabular kind of story. And when September 11th happened, it really overwhelmed the story. For a couple of years, I continued to set the novel before September 11th. But by 2003, I think it was quite obvious to me that a novel about a Pakistani guy who leaves New York the month before September 11th is still a September 11th novel. And I thought, you know, enough time had passed for me to begin to have some kind of novelistic response to the event, which is not the same as a journalistic response. It's not, you know, describe the event. It's try to step back and see the impact on people and not have them be overwhelmed by that event, have their story be, still be the dominant thing. So I tried to incorporate it at that point. But for me, September 11th is very much in the background. And even in the life of Chinggis, the main character, much of the changes that happen are internal to him. September 11th is a very visible symbol to him of certain things. But much of his trajectory was already in place, as it was in that first draft.
You have lived in the U.S. and you've lived in the U.K. You're based in London right now, I think. So do you think that Chinggis could be living in London instead of New York and still have the same experience? Because he feels an anguish, you know, wanting to be loving the American life and then not loving it.
I mean, I think that certainly, you know, there are people in England who've gone through an experience of leaving and of feeling alienated. But in some ways, to me, Chinggis' story is a particularly American one because it's the story of someone who falls in love with America. And it's a story of a love affair which, in a way, ends badly. And love affairs which end badly tend to have almost a very violent, you know, sense of the breakup tends to be violent. All sorts of anger is involved in that breakup because if you didn't love in the first place, you weren't so upset. I think the British Pakistani, British Muslim experience tends to be different from that. It's often a relationship, particularly in the north of England, the post-industrial wastelands, economic wastelands, you know, from which many Pakistanis grew up and some of the tube bombers grew up. That's a different experience. It's not of having loved the society, embraced the society, and then felt pulled away. I think that was an alienation which began from the very beginning and continue to develop. So in that sense, I think Chinggis' narrative is a peculiarly American story, even though where he ends up in the end may not be a peculiarly American place.
There are issues of class there involved, aren't there, too? I mean, the Pakistanis who come to America have tended to be more affluent and more professional class than the first and second waves of Pakistanis who went to Britain.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, there is a difference in class, but you know, in London now, there's a large population of South Asians and Pakistanis who are in professional types of occupations, a lot like they are in New York or New Jersey. And so in many ways, you can't even begin to talk about the Pakistani experience in Britain as a single experience. There's different experiences. But even, I think, for the South Asians who came to America, to Britain, in that professional sort of a class, in some senses, I don't think the animosity or the resentment or the love for the place are quite as strong as for those who came to America. Mm-hmm. In some ways, Britain allows you to remain different and is quite accepting of that difference. But because of that, you do remain something of a cultural outsider, I think, in Britain. In America, there's an insistence that you not remain an outsider. That gives you the opportunity both to be fully American, but also puts on you the burden of needing to conform more than you do in Britain.
So the novel has a lot of autobiographical elements in it. You grew up in Pakistan, and you went to Princeton, worked in corporate New York. And Cengiz, he feels this need to maybe return to Pakistan after September 11th. Did you feel the same need? Did you feel driven to go back to Pakistan?
I would hesitate to say that the novel contains autobiographical elements, because I think, autobiography obviously is the story of one's own life. I don't think Cengiz's story is my story. At a superficial level, there are similarities, obviously. And in my writing, I tend to write about things that I know and that I've experienced. So Mott Smoke is set in a Pakistan that I'm very familiar with. I know people who smoke joints. I've had a roommate who was a heroin addict. I've seen that side of things. Similarly, this novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, is set in a world which includes a Princeton, which I've known, a corporate New York, which I've known. But perhaps the most important difference for me is I spent a few years of my childhood in America. My father did his PhD here. So I lived in America from 1974 to 79, so about 4 or 5 years then. Then I came back for college. Then I stayed for law school. Then I worked in New York for 4 years. By the time I set out to write this novel, I'd lived, if not half of my life in America, a very large proportion. And so in many ways, the person that I am is more reflected by the novel as a whole, in the sense that the novel is half of a conversation between a Pakistani and an American. If you could imagine the American half of that conversation and add those two things together, that's more true of me. So Cengiz's story is not mine in that sense. But the question that you asked after that, which is, did I also feel a need to go back home after September 11th? Less so after September 11th, but after the near war with India and Pakistan, when that got kicked off, I actually did take a leave of absence from my job and returned to Pakistan for several months. For quite similar reasons, reasons similar to some of those that Cengiz has. A sense of wanting to be with my family, of sort of questioning what I was doing. But of course, in my case, I stayed for a few months, I left, and came back to London.
I read a novel that came out last year by John Updike. He's a popular American writer called Terrorist. Have you read the novel yet?
Yes.
And I'd like to know your feelings about it. What did you think?
I have enormous respect for Updike. I think he's an incredible novelist, and he's an incredible essayist as well. He's a very, very talented writer. But I think that for me, The Terrorist was not a completely successful novel. And the reason why I would say that is, I don't think Updike was successful in making the leap of empathy with the character that he wanted to create. He created a kind of automaton who functioned according to laws, sort of Islamic principles which governed him as a computer program would be governed. And he misunderstood that the people who act in these dramatic sort of, Western terrorist attack fashions don't think of themselves as computers and aren't. They think of themselves as the knights errant of the modern world. For them, it's a profoundly romantic quest that they're on. They're slaying dragons. And unless you can understand that side of it, the passion, the romance, the sense of purpose that's involved in the narrative, I think you misunderstand the point. It isn't the principles of Islam which result in these outcomes. It is the desire for glory or a certain kind of achievement of young men which result in these outcomes.
I don't, not to bash Updike, but he also wrote a novel set in Africa called The Coup.
I haven't read it.
Many years ago. I haven't read it either. But Paul Theroux wrote an essay about American writers who wrote novels set in Africa who had never been to Africa. And he cited The Coup in particular. From the reviews that I've read of terrorists, it really seemed as if Updike was well out of his depth. I mean, this was, he was writing about experiences that he couldn't possibly have the background to understand.
Well, you know, I don't know about whether one needs the background to understand. I don't think that Updike was wrong to take that as a topic and to attempt, you know, I mean, novel writing is an act of empathy. You have to imagine what it is being another person. For me, what's more interesting is not, you know, didn't Updike try to do something he was unequipped to do, but rather the question is, you know, when an American novelist of such, you know, capacity fails in his leap of empathy so visibly in that novel, it's quite interesting to me because I think it's almost a symptom of the society's broader failure to make that leap. You know, Updike, in his way, projected his imagination and imagined as much as he could, but he couldn't feel the passion of the character. He couldn't really believe the anger towards America. He instead created an inhuman protagonist. And I think that failure is, in some ways, you know, great novelists are an expression of their societies, and I think Updike is a great novelist, and his failure, in a way, in that sense, is symptomatic of I think, an American cultural failure to understand this phenomenon.
Maybe sympathetic in a very interesting and telling way.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think that he is, he tries to imagine what such a person may be, but what he constructs is not a person. Because in his universe, a person must have a kind of affection for America. You know, it's impossible to imagine where this comes from. And so therefore, you know, it's the impersonal that creates the hatred. And what he forgets is that there are many other narratives in the world. America's is just one of those narratives. And when narratives come into conflict, as they do in our globalized world more and more often, the pride of those who have less visibly successful narratives is not proportionate to how successful the narratives appear. They are equally proud of their narratives. And when they come up against the American narrative, the consequence is often anger and bruised egos. Imagining what that pride is, and then where that takes one, is something which I think is more interesting.
The names of the characters in your novel seem to be very carefully chosen. Chengiz, kind of, you know, powerful name, and his girlfriend, who's he has a love affair with, and which goes wrong. Erica, who couldn't get over Chris. So, are those? Is there? Did you choose those names purposely? Or?
I mean, I did, and I think the names do have certain resonances. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're sort of allegorical. You know, there's, to me, in a novel, oftentimes what you do is you create certain, you create the possibility and you facilitate the possibility of certain kinds of feelings and interpretations. And I think certain names do that more than others. But I wouldn't want to be, you know, so blunt as to say that this name symbolizes this thing and this person is that thing. And indeed, what you find is often people will find something very different. So some reviewers have said, aha, the character's name is Changes, and it's because he changes. And of course, his name isn't Changes at all, and I didn't even realize it could be read that way. It's Chengiz. Yeah. And if anything, Chengiz is of interest as a fundamentalist, because Chengiz, in medieval times, attacked the Arab Muslim civilization and would be a name that no religious fundamentalist would be expected to carry. So if any symbolism exists in the name Chengiz, it's something very different from the notion of Changes. But you do open yourself up to that when you give people names like that.
So can I ask about your writing process? Do you sit down to write a novel, or do you just sit down and write and the novel just comes?
Well, you know, I suppose it just comes, but it just comes in sort of, you know, 7 years of stuttering attempts. I mean, this novel I wrote first as a fable in the third person. I revised it, wrote in the first person in a very American-accented voice, the accent of a 22-year-old American college graduate. I found that voice could not be true to this character because he hadn't spent enough time in America to speak in that way. And so I looked for another voice. The voice that I came upon in this case was one which is rooted in a kind of Pakistani private school, which is a Victorian English, which is often deployed by people who are very insecure. It's used as an affectation to mask the fact that, you know, perhaps they're not as wealthy as their peers would be, and so therefore they speak in this way because they think it connotes a kind of family standing. And I thought that's the right voice for this character, and that voice opened him up a bit. And the frame came sort of towards the end. I thought, you know, who might he be speaking to? Why would he choose to be affected? What's the reason for this? And then I thought, well, if he's speaking to an American, I have the possibility of doing many things with that frame. And the frame, for me, opened up all sorts of possibilities. So just as the voice both suited the character, and also it has within it a sense of being anachronistic, of being formal, and therefore creating a sort of veiled presence, a sort of distanced presence, I think, and a sort of menace. I think that formality, that anachronistic quality, that sort of veiling and distance are all typical of sort of Western conceptions of Islam, and allowed me to play with those preconceptions in the voice. And the structure, in terms of the form, when I finally arrived at that structure, as opposed to a straight narrative or third person, first person, whatever it is, the dramatic monologue opens up space for you to play. Things can't happen like they do in dramatic monologues. A one-man play is an impossible thing. You know, it requires you to sort of say, okay, something artificial is happening here. There's artifice, there's art. But at the same time, within the realm of realism, you're not playing some sort of magical, realistic game. And that allows you, allowed me in this book, to create a relationship where we only see half of the relationship. And therefore, the reader is called to both judge that relationship and also to accept or resist the feeling that they may be one of these two people, and possibly the American who doesn't get a chance to speak back. And that, for me, the idea that you can create in a novel a relationship between a bearded Pakistani looking at American wondering, is he a regular guy? Is he here? CIA killer meant to get me? And an American person saying sort of the same thing, is he a terrorist? Is he a regular guy? Come here to get me? Allows you to create inside the novel the exact same tension, I think, that exists in the world today. That's how the West views the Muslim world in Pakistan. That's how Pakistan views the Muslim world in the West. Both sides wondering, are you regular people like us, or are you murderous killers?
So, and I wanted to ask you one more question. I want to ask you about the independent film scene in Pakistan. Mm. You've been part of that scene, kind of, you know. Your first novel, Maat Smok, was made into a play for television, Daira. So it seems like in the past 5 to 7 years, there's been just vibrant change in the independent film scene in Pakistan. Can you say something about that?
Well, I'm not part of that scene. No. I think, you know, what happened to me was the makers of Daira came to me and said, look, we'd really like to make this thing. And I said, you know, I wanted to support the evolution of television and film in Pakistan. I said, listen, don't pay me anything for this. You can go ahead and do it. I mean, you don't have any sort of exclusive rights to it, but you have my permission to make a telefilm out of it. And you know, I will encourage that in any way I can. And so I didn't have any qualitative control or financial stake or really direct involvement in the project beyond a hope that it could be part of what you were describing, which is this blossoming of narrative, visual narrative forms, you know, television and film in Pakistan. I think there has been a lot of progress, and TV in particular has been utterly transformed in Pakistan. And out of that firmament, we'll hopefully see some very exciting stuff.
You've only just published the book. It's been out since March in the UK and soon after that in Germany, and just last week it's been published in the US. You've spoken only to a couple of audiences in San Francisco. What kinds of responses have you had so far from audiences, and also I'm interested from Western audiences, and I'm also interested in whether you've had any responses yet from Pakistanis?
Well, you know, the response from Western audiences, it varies, obviously. In Germany, for example, I saw that some people were very uncomfortable with it. And I don't know, to a degree that was greater of people who read it in English in America and the UK. And I don't know if that was because in the presentations that were being made, I was being intermediated by a translator, and so therefore people presumed that I actually was this character, and I was basically this fundamentalist sort of a guy who hates America, and they were made very uncomfortable by that. I assumed that was what was happening because the body language and the kinds of questions I was getting they seemed very upset. Hmm. Strangely, you know, in the English language readings I've done, that's not been the case. And I was somewhat apprehensive of how people in America might respond, but quite interestingly, the response has not been one of people taking, you know, enormous offense to this book. I mean, some people obviously probably will, but, you know, it is written with hopefully a sense of affection for America, a sense of respect for what has happened, and without any attempt to mock or belittle those occurrences. And I think, generally speaking, people react differently when they can detect an intent which is not meant to be hurtful or mocking than when those things are present. And so, you know, we know of lots of times when people reacted very negatively to novels, and oftentimes there's been some sneaking suspicion that the novel has been there to mock or to do something like that. And I didn't want that to be the case. That said, there will be obviously different reactions. And I mean, the Pakistani reaction is interesting. It's, I think, it being published in Pakistan next week, and I think India around the same time or shortly afterwards, and many other countries in Europe, etc., in the next month or two. And so I'll have many more reactions. But the Pakistanis that I've spoken to in London, or who've come to my couple of readings here in the States, you know, have had interesting responses. I mean, many have been very positive. Some have been concerned that, you know, Pakistan already has this reputation of being this fundamentalist sort of a place, this scary place, and you're just adding to that reputation, which is particularly damaging because in your first novel you portrayed a very different Pakistan. So have you turned your back on, you know, trying to show that diversity of Pakistan, and you're showing some sort of stereotypical Pakistan? And, you know, that's really the flip side of the Pakistani reaction that some people had to Maud Smoke. Some people really liked Maud Smoke. And some people said, well, you know, this is showing a really terrible Pakistan. People do drugs and they sleep with their friends' wives. And, you know, and it's, and I think both of those Pakistani responses, negative responses, stem from the burden of representation that sits on Pakistani writers. There are excellent Pakistani novelists, obviously, in Urdu and English, but there aren't very many of us in English who are published internationally. And so therefore, you know, when somebody publishes, there's a feeling that they're actually trying to represent the country, almost like an ambassador. And I think I can understand where that comes from, but I don't think it's a fair burden to place on the shoulders of a novelist. You know, you're trying to be honest, and you're trying to create something which engages you and hopefully a reader. You're not trying to say that this is what all Pakistanis are like, or even most Pakistanis are like. But at the same time, you know, many Pakistanis have not reacted in that way. It's less about the representation and more, you know, hopefully that they detect a certain, you know, honesty or something that resonates with them in the story. And it'll be interesting when the book comes out in Pakistan how it reacts. Because Maud Smoke, which is a novel about Pakistan, in many ways will have a different reaction than this, which is a novel about America. Mm. You know, people will perhaps see themselves in Maud Smoke, or did see themselves in Maud Smoke. And when they read this novel, they may not, if they haven't left Pakistan and lived in the States. Or they may, I don't know. But that is a big difference.
Mm. You've been, I think, fairly brave and forthright about allowing yourself to comment publicly on events, political events, current events in Pakistan, notably in what I thought was a very good op-ed in the March 27th New York Times, where you wrote, by prolonging his rule, Musharraf risks taking Pakistan backward and undermining much of the considerable good that he has been able to achieve. You gave, I thought, a more nuanced sense of the political situation in Pakistan than I've heard elsewhere recently. So what do you have to say? Are you pro-Musharraf or anti-Musharraf?
I think it's actually very complicated, the whole thing. I certainly have spoken out in support of Musharraf in the past, you know, to a certain extent. There are elements of what Musharraf has done in the past which I've spoken in support of. I am now, obviously, as my writing, as what you've just quoted and my other op-eds that I've written suggest, very concerned and deeply questioning the, you know, the benefits that Musharraf brings, and trying to think of how do we move forward. But it does seem to me that some sort of accommodation needs to be reached between the legitimate mainstream political parties in Pakistan, particularly the PPP, which is now currently not involved in Musharraf's government, and the army, whether that's Musharraf or not Musharraf. Because what we've seen in the past in the 1990s was, if the army isn't on board, it will undermine the functioning of the civilian government. So even though you have a democracy, the prime minister isn't actually allowed to get on with the business of governing the country. So how does Pakistan find a way to achieve some kind of compromise that the army allows the prime minister, elected prime minister, to govern the country, Yet at the same time, the elected prime minister will function in a way which is somewhat circumscribed by what the army demands. Now, that's certainly not what we would call pure democracy. It isn't also what we have today, which feels much less democratic to that. It's something in between. It's a kind of a compromise thing. I'm not saying that this is the ideal outcome for Pakistan, but it's something I could actually imagine happening, and which I think if it did happen would be for the best, because at the moment Pakistan is very divided. You know, there are very liberal people, there's people on TV, you know, in rock videos and models and transvestite TV interviewers. And there are also obviously the people on the border with Afghanistan who are currently engaged in fighting with the government. That is a huge, you know, gap which needs to be bridged, and it's bridged through dialogue and conversation. And in the end of the day, the people who are best able to have those dialogues, conversations, are politicians. And bringing as many people back as possible into the fold, having that conversation get started, moving from what we have now, which is a much more autocratic setup, to one that's much more broad-based, even if initially it's halting steps that take us through, you know, semi-democracy, etc. All of that would be a positive direction for me. What would be a negative direction is if we retrench and go to a place where actually more and more power begins to reside in the army chain of command, in General Musharraf, etc. Because that, I don't think, is sustainable. And we're beginning to see that system already creaking under its own weight.
Did Benazir Bhutto miss an opportunity when she did not return to Pakistan in March to lead some kind of movement? It felt for a few days, at least, in there that opportunity might have been there. Aung San Suu Kyi refused to leave Burma when she was offered that opportunity.
Well, there's a big difference between Benazir and Aung, I would say. Based on past performance, I can't say that I'm some huge supporter of Benazir Bhutto. But I will say that, in my personal experience, she enjoys enormous popular support, particularly among poorer people. And one has to recognize that support. And because she then enjoys that support, it's very important that she play a role in Pakistan's political future, regardless of what one thinks of her past attempts to do that. I don't think she necessarily missed a trick by not coming in March, because I don't think this is an outflanking maneuver that somebody can pull off. I think actually what needs to happen is some sort of grand compromise needs to be struck. Benazir needs to be in conversation with Musharraf. They need to be in conversation with the Pakistan Muslim League. Some rules of play need to be hammered out, and the mainstream parties and the army need to go forward with that. I think if Benazir were to try to surprise or to suddenly dictate a change in the situation, what will happen is the army won't necessarily go back to barracks, and then we're stuck once again. So because of all of that, I think in some ways what one hears about back-channel negotiations, about deals being struck, are actually very encouraging, and I hope that those things are happening.
Final question, or a couple questions. Are you writing or planning another novel at the moment, and do you have any plans to quit your day job?
It's funny because, as far as the new novel is concerned, I'm always planning a new novel, and for me, the first step is I buy a notebook, and I bought my notebook, and my Reluctant Fundamentalist, I bought this gorgeous orange, suede-bound, bright, beautiful leather notebook from Tuscany, and produced this kind of grim novel in it. So this time I bought this black, severe moleskin notebook, and I'm hoping to produce a very lighthearted book inside it. I'm jotting down my thoughts. What I do is I sort of map out my characters, I map out my plot, I just have it build in my head, get to know it better and better and better, until I'm so hungry that I have to write. That takes usually several months, even a year. And I'm doing that now. It's a bit too soon to say what it's about, but that it's percolating. In terms of the day job, there's two parts to having a day job. One is the financial security that comes from that, and with that, the independence I think a writer gets to take the time to write the books they want to, because you always have a day job. It's just that your day job isn't working for a publisher, it's working for a company, and the stuff you do for the publisher you do on your own terms. So there is that aspect of it. But separate from that aspect of it, there is, writing can be a very isolating and alienating experience as well. And I've learned so much from the work that I've done, you know, whether it's been as a journalist, whether it's been schools I've attended, whether it's been as a management consultant or my current part-time job in London. And, you know, I think knowing what it's like to work with people, to have a salary, you know, to have a boss, you know, to deal with the human resources department. These are things that are now for sort of professional urban human beings across the world, you know, commonplace things in which I think as a writer, it's good to have some exposure to. So it's not clear to me if, you know, what will happen to my day job. You know, we shall see. And also in the past, what's happened with me is I've had day jobs, quit day jobs, and gone to other day jobs. So, you know, that could happen as well.
Yeah. Let's hope it's not another 7 years before your next novel comes out.
Thanks very much.
Thanks. Many thanks to you.